Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. We are going to have back on with us today Cardell Sims, founder of Visionary Hustler, LLC, a company that engineers clients for greatness and success, a master certified empowerment life coach, consultant, author, and speaker, who teaches how to manifest one's vision and be boss of one's own mission by focusing on results and eliminating excuses. Free, F-R-E-E. Following two extensive sentences, he faced himself in a state and federal prison. Cardell Sims transformed his own life from convicted felon to a certified entrepreneur, inmate to inspiration. Cardell doesn't stop at that. He is also the founder, president of the Northside Organization, Reinventing the Honor, N-O-R-T-H, North, a nonprofit organization that enriches education and encourages others to their purpose and to fulfill their destiny. Cardell also teaches felon reentry education. Cardell is a native of Sedalia, Missouri, and pours his time into helping people grow from being an inmate to their freedom. Cardell will talk about his downfall, his growth, and his mission to save others. There are so many in the world today that have made mistakes, that have done their crime, and many people say if you do the crime, you do the time. But sometimes there are things that happen in life today that makes everyone make a mistake because no one was born perfect. And when someone transforms their life from a felon or making a mistake to doing something positive in life and trying to help others to prevent them from going through the same situations and also to be productive in any way they can. And that is Cardell Sims. I don't know if Cardell is on the line with us. Are you on with us, Cardell?
Yeah, I'm on. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. How are you today?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. How about yourself?
I'm doing very well, very well. So, Cardell, as I mentioned to the audience, we did have a brief interview the other day. However, I made some error, which made it a very short interview. So we'd like to have you start from the beginning today and do the whole show. And we also have on with us Deborah Cicera, who is going to be co-hosting with me today. And Deborah, are you on with us?
Oh, yes, I am. Yes, grace okay. And peace to you all.
You too, Deborah. And
me too.
We have Cardell Sims on the phone on the interview with us. And we did mention briefly a little bit about Cardell, but he's going to be talking about his story from felon to certified entrepreneur. So let's hear it, Cardell, and thank you so much once again for being on with us. We're honored to have you.
Thanks a lot for having me. My story is I grew up in a impoverished neighborhood. My mom was on drugs. My father wasn't nowhere around. So I learned how to hustle at an early age, and I had adapted the mindset that I was a product of my environment. And with that mindset, by the time I was a teenager, I found myself in juvenile detention centers, and I ended up in a foster home. While in a foster home, all I did was play basketball, so I became real good, and the basketball skills took me to college. But I carried that mindset with me to college as well. So while I was in college, I wasn't doing the average things that your student athlete should be doing. Really wasn't going to class. I was involved in street activities. Robbing, selling drugs, partying, like that was my college life. So once my basketball career was done and over with, I found myself back at home selling crack cocaine, hanging out on the block over the gang that I grew up with. And while out there, I ended up catching two drug cases and a gun case and getting sentenced to 19 years in the Missouri Department of Corrections. I was actually sentenced to a 7-year sentence and a 12-year sentence, and they was ran consecutively, what we call running wild. which means I had to do the 7-year sentence, and then when I was done with the 7 years, I had to do the 12-year sentence before I was released. So while I was in the Missouri Department of Corrections, all I did was play basketball, smoke Black & Milds, cigarette, drink coffee, sit on the yard and talk about really a little bit of nothing, which rapper had the most money, what I was doing out on the streets, what girl looked good, just a bunch of frivolous conversations. So while doing my time, the Missouri Senate passed a bill on drug cases, which cut my time in half, and I was up for release. So when I was released with the same mentality, went right back to the same neighborhood, hung around the same people, started selling the same drugs. The recidivism rate says that 44% of the offenders that are released within 1 year, they reoffend. And I fell right into that recidivism rate. Within 1 year, I reoffended, and I found myself sitting in the county jail facing and fighting another drug case. So while I was sitting in the county jail, I ended up beating that drug case on a technicality, and I got out and did the same thing. So I was out for about 2 or 3 years, and before I know it, the federal government came to pick me and 31 other people from my neighborhood on my block and hit us with conspiracy charges and gang activity charges. So I was facing the federal government. It was my name versus the United States of America. And I knew it was real then. And I started asking myself, like, how did I keep finding myself in these situations? And I told myself that I was the first victim of my own actions and that I had to change my mentality. So while facing that federal time and getting ready to get sentenced, I just started reading Knowledge of Self books, Seed of the Soul, Business Law, business books. Like, I just started changing my whole mentality and started feeding my mind away from hood novels and things of that nature. And then I started coming up with ideas and plans and goals of what I wanted my life to be like whenever I get released, because I didn't know when I was going to be released, if I was going to be released. But I still was preparing myself because I wanted to be ready. I mean, you hear people say that they ready to get out of jail or get out of prison, but you be ready, but you don't be prepared. I actually wanted to be prepared when I got released. So I started setting goals, like I said, plans, ideas, and I started drawing out my life and started just working on that. So when I got my sentence from the federal government, and I went to United States Penitentiary in Leavenworth, Kansas. Most people in their cell, they have a picture board of cars, of their family and everything. I didn't have that in my cell. I actually had my picture board was a vision board of what I wanted my life like. So every day I got up, I said thank you. I said a prayer, and I said an affirmation before my feet hit the ground. That's what I did. And I looked up at my vision board, and I attacked my day to learn about how I can compass names on my vision board. So when I was up for release, all I had to my name was 4 brown legal folders. And in them legal folders was just plans, goals, ideas, and a blueprint of what I was going to do as soon as I got released. So once I got released, I went to the halfway house. My first day in the halfway house, I found out where the computer was. I started researching a lot of things, and I ended up taking a life coaching course. I took the life coaching course, and within 6 months, I got a life coaching diploma. But I continued my education and ended up doing it longer and became a master certified empowerment life coach. As soon as I got my empowerment life coaching, this was all part of my plan. As soon as I got my master in empowerment life coaching, I went and got me a business license for my company, Visionary Hustler, LLC, and I was going to help people manifest their vision and be the boss of their mission. And so that's what I got. And like I said, this was planned from before I even got out of prison. I had the name and everything. So I went around and started setting up my own speaking engagements. I started setting up my own vision board classes, started setting up individually coaching people, and I just went out there and put the footwork in. And the next thing you know, people just started giving me a call, wanted to hear my story and paying me to hear my story, and I started getting coaching clients as well. Then I wanted to rebuild the neighborhood that I helped destroy. And so I said, well, I'm going to start a nonprofit organization called North, because I grew up on the north side of the town. And I said I wanted to reinvent the honor of my neighborhood, because it was destroyed, and I helped destroy it, and it just wasn't no value. So I wanted to bring back value. So I started the nonprofit organization, Northside Organization Reinventing the Honor, and that's what it was geared to, rebuilding the neighborhood, the community, and bringing the value back, because I believe that if people could step out their homes and see values, they will find value in themselves. So that's what I did, and that's where I met them. And so within the North organization, I said I wanted to help people get out of prison that's facing things that they face, but be able to be successful. And what I mean by successful is not completing their probation and parole. It's never returning to prison. And so I came up with the Felon Reentry Education Program, and that's what I'm really focused on right now, is my free, I call it my free program, and that's where I'm at.
I find that, I'll tell you, this is one of the things that I find very, very interesting, and it's inspiring. There are so many people that do come out of prison that want to do something with their lives. They don't know where to begin. They don't know how to begin. And where you are a life coach, I can understand someone like you would be so beneficial to them. But also the fact that you just said you came out, you wanted to rebuild a community that, you know, you thought that you had a part in, you know, bringing down, and to have that mentality, to have that passion and that vision to try to do something so positive, you know, it's almost as though God had a purpose for you actually being in prison and coming out, because he's using you in a big way to make these changes, positive changes, and to help others. And I don't know, Deborah, you do some kind of community work too. So what are your thoughts on these? Or do you have any feedback on what Cardell is talking about?
Well, the subject and the topic that he is talking about, I find it very necessary and very well needed, because some of the things that our communities, like he said, I'm listening very close and very carefully. Matter of fact, that's something that was on my agenda even for the last few days. And people, they really need someone. They need that guidance. And what he's saying, that a lot of these things that's going on in these communities, we need strong people. We need people like him and that are doing things like that for the individual, because sometimes people, they need somebody to know that they're there in their corner. Because right now I have some things that I would discuss with you afterwards that I'm dealing with. And so this is really like my topic right now. And I've been doing some things over the course of the day on behalf of people. And what he's doing is so well needed right now, because we have a lot of areas where we do have young people. We have people that are very troubled. And what he does right now is very well needed at the time. You know, they need to know that they have someone. They need to know that there's someplace that they could turn to. They need to know that there's opportunities. They need to know that who is and who's not their friend. And they just look
exactly
for some place so they could feel like they belong. And they make
exactly
the wrong choices sometimes. And they need good leadership, that someone can steer them right, to let them know about their talent. I always minister about talent, that our children and our people, they are so smart. They have talent, but that we have a lot of people that does not recognize. And you don't have people with the that type of spirit or that anointed or that knowledge that will reach out. And to reach out to these people, they need it. People
exactly
need what he's doing. They really need it right now, especially
and,
our people,
and it would
because
be,
there's a lot of troubled homes and everything.
And it would be good maybe after the show, you know, for you and Cardell to actually talk about ways that you can work together or work on some of these issues. I network a lot. I network with advocates across the country in the organization that I have, the New Vision organization. And so I network with, because what maybe you may be doing in your state alone, someone else may be doing in their state, and someone else in their state. And by networking with others in the country, you can share experiences and you can also share information. One of the things I tell everyone is, even though Cardell may be in Missouri, Deborah, you may be in New York, I'm in Massachusetts, we have relatives or we have friends in other states who need the guidance as well. And by having that resource, being able to talk about the resources, it's very beneficial, because if I know someone in Missouri that I feel Cardell could help, I'm going to contact Cardell and I'm going to say, Cardell, can you reach out to this person, or have this person reach out to you? The same thing in New York, Deborah, with your the work that you're doing. But Cardell, I wanted to hear more about when you were in prison, some of the things that you experienced while in prison, and some of the problems you may have had when you first came out. Can you touch base on those issues?
I mean, one thing, I mean, in prison, I mean, especially in federal prison, is, let's just say I done did prison and jail time in many different type of environments before I went to the federal prison. When I got to the federal prison in what we call the USPs, it's really different. It helped me understand the system for real, because you were just in there. It wasn't a lot of programs to help. You had to take it up on yourself to better yourself. I always tell people the reentry starts with you, and it starts on the first day that you go into prison. Like, you need to really figure out exactly what you really want to do. I mean, you can engage in the activities that's going on in prisons, drugs, alcohol, gangs, or you can engage in knowledge, going to the library and hanging around people that's growing and want to do something with themselves when they get out. I experienced a lot of things in prisons, from stabbings, whether it was on inmate to inmate or inmate to staff. You see a lot of staff really just don't care. I mean, they don't care about your safety. When you got two guards that run a whole unit that is 500-600 inmates in this one unit, that's really no safety in that at all, because they just sit at the desk at the office. I mean, I experienced lockdowns for months where we weren't able to get on the phone, contact our family. Sarah once a week. I mean, I just seen a lot of indifferences, injustices inside the prisons. No air, no AC, no AC, no heat in the winter, sometimes no water. I mean, as when I got out, the challenges that I faced was trying to get one was employment. People, they give you a list that says these are the companies that hire felons. But what they don't tell you, like what they say, the fine print, what they don't tell you is, yeah, they hire felons, but your felony has to be within so many, after so many years. So yeah, we hire felons, but if you got your felon was within 7 years, then we can't hire you. It has to be after 7 years. So you face with not only the fact that you're a felon, but you face with that twist of the game, because you get a list saying, oh, this company hire felons, and you go to these companies, and then they say, oh yeah, we hire felons, but your felon has been within your felony has been within the last 5 years, so we can't hire you.
And so it's ridiculous.
And so when I see people post in groups that we're in, I see people post the companies that hire felons. I always make sure it's my business to let them know, yeah, these companies hire felons, but your felony has to be within so many years. I went through that so much when I first got out, and that kind of pushed me more to stay on my blueprint and get my knowledge and then start my business. I also housing, transportation, getting out with no transportation, and being in a halfway house is kind of hard, because I had to choose a halfway house that wasn't where I was risen from. Because the halfway house where I was originally from is stuck right in the middle of a violent neighborhood. And I've known people that didn't make it out that halfway house. Like, as soon as they stepped out the halfway house, from past problems that they had on the streets, they got killed. Or they have to carry a gun with them in the halfway house. Like, people was getting caught with guns in the halfway house. So I made a decision. That was one of the conscious decisions I made. I'm going to go to a different halfway house, so I don't have to put myself back in an environment. And so now I'm away from home, so I don't know no one, and the transportation. You get a bus pass, but once that bus pass runs out, it's like, how are you going to get, you know, to where you're going? Just a lot of things that you face getting out of prison, mentor. And with me, I wanted to find a mentor that's been through what I went through and made it out so I can figure out how did you do it. And because it's hard to have a mentor and they don't really understand the positions that you're in or where you're from. Or that's why when I do my federal reentry education, the people that I work with, they relate to me because I've been in their shoes. I know exactly what they're facing. And when I go speak with the kids, I do another movement called No New Numbers. And where I go speak to troubled teens, juvenile facilities, youth build communities that look like they're on the path of going to prison, and I challenge their beliefs, I raise their expectations, and I help them prioritize their values so they don't become a new number in the prison system. Because this is my personal opinion, I believe in we talk about reform, I believe in changing mandatory minimums. I don't think that's crazy. I believe in attacking recidivism, but I also understand the prison system. The prison system gets paid off of numbers, how many numbers they can get in there. So if I've been to prison and got out, I already got my number. So if I get on parole or probation and get sent back, they're not going to get that much money for me because I already got a number. They get their money from the new numbers. And so I think the way that we attack the prison is by no new numbers. Get a hold of all the youth that we can that look like they're on their way to prison. Educate them about how the prison system works and see the environment they come from, where they just believe that they're going to be a product of their environment. Challenge their beliefs, you know, raise the expectations for themselves, like through talent, like she said earlier, through talent. You know, just tap into your talent and also prioritize what you value. And prioritizing your value, and that raises value in yourself.
I'd like to ask you, and also Deborah, I'd like to ask both of you, what are your thoughts right now on defunding the law enforcement and defunding the Department of Corrections across the country? We'll start with you, Deborah.
Deborah, you can go ahead.
Okay, so as I'm hearing that you just said that as far as the defunding from the police department and the defunding from the prison?
Yes.
Okay. Well, the real true reason why I feel that, you know, this came about in reference to the pre-policing is because of the issues that took place. I feel that what they did, they have not prepared these people the way they should. And, you know, there are certain rules when it comes to the police that they feel they don't have to, you know, they don't have to serve or they don't have to recognize. And I really feel that they failed in that. But I do feel that right now, far as money is needed, you know, it's very hard to really, like, but there's money is needed. But far as the prison, now, I do feel that far as the prisons, I know that the prisons are lacking so many things in so many areas. I don't feel that they need to defund them. Now, I will say that. I feel that they need to have more programs inside that prison, and they need more for the ones that's coming out, and they need them in place for the ones that will be doing a longer period of time. There are so many things that's really lacking in the prison. First of all, a lot of things going on in these prisons behind the walls that people don't know about. But since I have visited prisons many a time, a lot of things can deter you. A lot of things can make you feel like you don't want to go back. Even you go there and you are a person of good standard, that prison will make you feel like, you know, you a criminal. It has that way of doing that because, like I said, I visit, I go, you know, I have visit people in the prison. And the process, if you go to, like, some of the prisons that I've been to, that you have to go to so many security checks. And a lot of people they do need the funding, because a lot of people do not have family to reach out to them, because some people cannot visit them. Some people cannot go through that. They really need to. And then we have a lot of cases, too, that they already they place these people in prison. A lot of people are thrown in jail for things that they shouldn't be thrown in jail for.
Exactly.
So it's a lot to look at when it comes down to that, far as the funding. I do feel that they need, because they said that they have lack of security, they have lack of this. And there's truth. Like he said, there are some people, they in that little small, now right now this COVID is going on, they in less than 6 feet and stuff. They really do need a lot of funding. They need more funding for them. Now, the police officers, like I said, well, there's a lot of things going on, and if you really watch, we have some good officers and we have some bad.
You know, in my 20 years of advocating for the incarcerated men, women, and youth, I will say one thing, and I'll say this all the time. I believe the Department of Corrections across the country, as well as law enforcement, do need to be defunded. I don't believe in prison. Because we have an epidemic in this country, as I mentioned to Cardell the other day, we have an epidemic in this country of substance abuse issues. We have an epidemic of mental health issues. We have an epidemic of anger issues. We have in this country an epidemic of racism, and we have an epidemic right now with this pandemic that's going throughout the world. I believe that the money should be reverted from the prisons and from the law enforcement agencies to programs to establish long-term residential substance abuse treatment programs or facilities, long-term residential treatment for mental health, and long-term residential treatment facilities for anger management. We do not need to fund an organization called the Department of Corrections across this country, when in fact they're getting all this funding. Prisoners are not eating well. They're eating mashed potatoes and rice, anything to fatten them up. But the good food is going to the staff. The same thing with law enforcement. We have to, and there are good and bad, even in the corrections department and in law enforcement, there are good and bad. But the problem is the good ones are not reporting the bad ones. And that's why when so many police officers are killed out in the street, and a lot of times they may be the good ones, it's because their own peers, the bad ones, don't give a hoot about them and continue to do the evil things that they do, putting their own peers, their good peers, in harm's way. So if the good ones see that their own peers don't care about them, why are they defending them, or why are they preventing the truth from coming out about them? So I believe that these facilities should be established. I believe that they should be overseen. I believe there should be committees to make sure that they have the right resources in these newly established long-term residential treatment programs, and do away with prisons, or keep prisons only for terrorists or serial killers. But the prisons are not doing anything. We have a pandemic right now. All visits throughout the country have been suspended in the penal system. But yet there's a lot of prisoners who are still out there doing drugs. Where are the drugs coming from? You know, they strip families and friends that go into the prisons, and now that there's none of them going in, who's bringing those drugs in? There's only one answer to that question. And anybody with wisdom and discernment, anyone with the right mind, is going to know exactly where those drugs are coming from. And they're going to know exactly why there's so many people that work in the penal system that are being caught, that are being reported, that are being fired, that are being charged. That's my feedback. Cardell?
My feedback on the defunding of prisons, I look at it like this. On the average cost of an inmate per year is around about $31,000 per inmate per year to house, feed, and secure people in state or federal prison. I mean, in some states, as much as $60,000 that taxpayers are footing the bill on, you know. And I'm a $31,000 per inmate. Yeah, that no. I mean, it's not like they get new clothes. It's not like the food that they're getting is top of the line. You're getting used clothes, used jumpsuits, used socks, used boxers. The food is. You're talking about horse oats, and, you know, the food's not top of the line. So can I think that could be cut? Yeah, it could be cut. It should be cut. To implement programs inside the prisons that's actually helpful. I mean, only programs. Now, I'm not saying all prisons because, you know, when I was in that work, they did have a serve safe, a program where you get your serve safe. So if you want to get into the food industry when you get out, this if you can get the job, this certificate can put you in a certain position. But you still got to get over the felony skint anyway. They had hotel and lodging where it'd give you you can graduate the class. It was funded through the college that was close to Leavenworth, and you graduate and you get a hotel and lodging certificate from the Hotel and Lodging Institute down in Florida. I mean, but majority of your prisons don't have these type of programs. So you going in and you just in there, no education outside GED. With substance abuse, yeah, they have NAA programs inside the prisons, but they are ran by the inmates. You don't have no, all your programs, majority of your programs are ran by the inmates. So you're not bringing no specialists in. So that means you're not spending no money in. So, and that's outside the $31,000 that you already getting per inmate, because now you got a education budget that you have in the prison. Not only the education budget, you have the chapel has a budget to fund the religious services. And so these type of budgets, I think, if you're not using it correctly, it needs to be taken away from you. And it's plain to see that you're not using it correctly. I feel like if you have a substance abuse problem, prison ain't the answer.
Prison's not
the answer. Because I know a lot of people that got substance abuse problems, and they get in prison, and drugs is there, alcohol is there. So if they don't want to stop, they're not going to stop in this setting. And, I mean, this is how inmates think. Is I'm going to be here for a while. I'm not trying to better myself. I'm just going to come in. Where's the drugs? Where's the alcohol? And that's just how they live their life. I know so many people when I was in prison that's what they did. And not only just we even talking about prescription drugs. Like, I know people that get to prison. I've seen people that get to prison and start taking these pills, and every day at med call, it's a line of people lined up outside the infirmary waiting on these pills, and these pills help them escape reality, and then 6 months, they don't know who they are. I feel like substance abuse programs should be implemented in the communities. And that should be
exactly
the first, second, and third option. I'll give you four options. The first, second, and third option should be these substance abuse programs in the community. Mental health issues. 15-20% of people in prison have mental health issues. I don't feel that locking somebody inside of a box is going to help them deal with their mental health issues.
No.
And you don't have a mental health specialist inside of a prison. You'd send them down to the infirmary, and they talk to what's going on with you. You explain what's going on, and then they give you some meds, and then in 6 months you don't know who you are.
And I've heard that from so many other incarcerated individuals. As far as taking the medication, if they're in pain, some don't want to take the medication because they say it makes them like zombies. Once they become like zombies, they're vulnerable to other prisoners and staff.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. I've always been against, like, I've seen it so many times, so many years, where people are standing in these long lines, 7 o'clock med call, and it's like they racing to get these meds, because now their body has adjusted to these meds, and now they got to have it. Their body is, they have to have it, and it just their body has adjusted to them, and they in 6 month time with them taking these meds, and they simply dealing with mental health problems. And there's no one inside the prison that is qualified for this, so we just going to give them meds, and then now they're on meds, and in 6 months, their mental health is worse, and they just don't know who they are. So then when it's time to come back for release, not only does your mental health condition worsen, but you have lost a lot of faculties to let's say mental faculties to make certain decisions. because these meds have wore that down. So now you just release and you just out there and you just want to go find someone where you can get the meds. You got your medical paper. This is what I was taking in prison, when you go to a halfway house or a transition house, and I need to get these meds. And so now you out here with the meds and you're not getting to mental health. So I think it's a necessity, especially these days, for mental health places outside of prison, because there's none in prison.
Exactly.
And that goes with defunding the police as well. If I could say something real quick on that, I think you need to take the funds and allocate some of these police officers. They need mental health help as well. And you need to allocate some of the funds that you're getting that's really not doing anything, maybe going into the pension or whatever, and get these police officers mental help so they can be able to be mentally strong to dealing with certain situations and understanding people, so they won't be so quick to pull the trigger and kill somebody.
You know, I think training is one of the things they talk about all the time. And in many cases, it's not the training that's needed. It's to wean out the bad ones, because a lot of it's because of hatred or retaliation or vengeance or racism. And every time somebody is killed, whether it be a young black male, whether it be a young black woman, or whether it just be people in society because of the police brutality, the first thing they come out with is more training. If they can't be trained in the beginning and throughout, which they're already receiving ongoing training, why do they think that that's going to be the solution to the problem every time innocent people are shot in the back? You know, it doesn't make sense. But as far as the medical and mental health in the prisons, they contract out with medical providers. They have a contract with them. But once those medical providers are in the penal system and are under the oversight of the Department of Corrections, they pretty much go along with what the prison officials want them to do or not to do. Because I know so many prisoners who have been denied medical treatment and who are still suffering after a year or two with medical conditions that they have been suffering with, and they have been pleading for help, MRIs or whatever, and it's always physical therapy. If somebody is in pain and physical therapy is not working, they need to do more. These things here are another issue that they need to look at. Like you said, they need to bring these programs, these medical people from the outside in. They need to be more in having more healthcare providers coming in from the outside and not just contracting with a certain population and then actually telling them what to do. And they do it. They listen to the Department of Corrections officials.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then you have to look at the, as far as like the mental health and the medication, a lot of experiment medication goes on in prison. Before it hits the market on the world market, is experimenting with those inmates in prison. Just like when you think about when COVID first hit, they came out and said, oh, this is going to work. And then next thing you know, $60,000 worth was gotten by the federal prisons.
Wow.
You know, and so I can't remember the name of the medicine.
It starts with a Q.
There's tons of it in the prisons
bought,
now across the country.
Yeah, and it's in the system now. So now you're looking at the rise. If you really look at the COVID numbers in prisons, it's way worse than it is on outside. And in prisons, you can't social distance in the prisons. There's no way to social distance in the prisons. But this is the thing. Outside, if you shut down visitations, it's just like you said with the drugs. Because you go through all these strip searches and you go through a lot of stuff just to get to and from visits, you know. And so it's with, like COVID. If you shut down the visits and the numbers are still coming in, how are these numbers coming in? Through staff. So you got staff coming in with COVID, whether they know it or they're asymptomatic. but it affects the inmates, and all it takes is one inmate to catch COVID in the prison, and it's going to spread just like that because there's no social distance. You're already two, if not three, in some prisons I've been in, it's 5-6-man cells to a cell. So then you go out in the day room, you're not social distance in that way. You're using the phones, they probably not getting clean. And so it's easy to contact. I mean, even just a regular virus, when people get sick in the prison, most likely a lot of people are going to end up sick because it spreads just like that. You can't social distance from that situation. And the numbers in prisons are showing that people are dying. And that's why they're trying to let people get released early during their age and their health conditions. But at the same time, it's you cannot get away from COVID inside of a prison.
I agree with that.
I really believe they need to bring in people from the outside to oversee what's going on the inside of these prisons. Another thing is right now with the coronavirus, you mentioned, Cardell, not being able to social distance in the prisons. What I'm finding out is that there are so many empty cells in the prisons that are not being reported. And people are being forced, even during this pandemic, people are being forced to double cell. And that doesn't make sense. And we have it right here in Massachusetts, at Sousa Baranowski Correctional Center, one of the supermax here, one of the worst prisons here. And they have all these empty cells, and yet they're trying to force people, or they have forced people to double cell. So what's the purpose of these single cells, especially during this time? Plus the fact that they have taken their televisions, they're being confined 23 hours a day, and this is going on all over the country. Politicians are actually trying to do something about it, but there's so much power. This is why I'm all in favor of defunding. There's so much power in law enforcement and DOC, Department of Corrections, that they're doing anything that they want to do, and no one can stop them. It's like the leadership of this country. No one seems to be able to stop it. The only way to stop it is through the pocket, and that's to defund, take the monies from it, instead of funding these facilities, instead of funding them, put it into something that's positive with social workers, counselors, psychiatrists, psychologists, doctors. You know, address it all in these different types of facilities all over the country. Establish them, oversee them, and let's see these people that are suffering in prison and that are being deprived and provoked and harassed and set up and medically, psychologically, and spiritually neglected. Let them all be in these areas, these facilities that are going to actually do something for them instead of making them worse. So many prisoners are committing suicide in these prisons. So many of them are dying, and it's alleged to be suicides when it's homicide by officials and guards. People need to look at these issues because it's not going to get any better. It's going to get worse. Even with this pandemic, it's all over. It's already entered the prison. These people that work for the prison, the penal system, they go home, they go out in the community, they do all these things, and a lot of them even probably don't even wear masks or gloves. And then they go back into the prison. We got a major issue in this country. And next week, on the 14th of July, I will be interviewing Marianne Jacobs from the Netherlands. She's going to be coming on the show. She's a psychotherapist, a psychosocial therapist. She's worked in the prisons in the Netherlands. And they have like 43 or 63 lifers, people serving life sentences, life without. And here we have 165,000. That goes to show you there's something definitely wrong in this country. Their success rate, even in Norway, there's a video on YouTube that talks about the Norway prisons, the penal system, the successes. And they don't have prison bars. They say the guards that they hire, they have that social work ability as well. So they're not only overseeing, they're also treating them. They're also befriending them. They're treating them like human beings. This country is a country of hatred, as I say, racism, a country of vengeance, retaliation. It's who you know. There's a couple of lawyers, even in Massachusetts, who are so corrupt because they would take a case and they would charge $4,000 or $5,000 to meet with the client one time and do absolutely nothing. they get away with it. There's a lot of things that go on in this country.
Yeah, that's part of the system. I think prison is just the me personally, prison is just the final result of this how the system works. You know, I was explaining this to someone the other day. I mean, you have it's called the bail game. So you have people, you know, that are innocent of the case, but may so-called fit the description. They get arrested. Now they are in jail with a bond and a bail that they cannot pay. So they sit there. So this is the trap right here. So now you sit there 3 or 4 months. You don't have money for a lawyer. You can't pay a bail. And they say, look, you know, we got you on this. And you thinking in your mind, I know I didn't do it, but I cannot win because I'm already locked up for something I didn't do, and I can't even get out. So now it's the point where you're guilty until proven innocent. And so they say, well, look, we're going to take you to trial and you can get 30 years, or you can go ahead and take this 3 years right now, and, you know, you'll be out in 6-7 months, and you already done did 5-6 months. Even though you're innocent, it's, you know.
You have, yeah.
47,
you now have,
yeah.
You now have a label. We have a caller on with us right now, Cardell. We have a caller on. Could you please state your name? Hello? I guess they just want to listen. Okay.
And that's
but
what
as
happens
you,
to
as you
some
were saying,
people.
Cardell, yeah. Finish, because that's an interesting. Other people, other prisoners have said the same thing.
Yeah, that's how it works. Like that's the final straw. And so it's like, oh man, I didn't do it, but they already got me here. And so if I go to trial, I feel like I'm going to lose in trial and get 30 years. And so I don't want to do 30 years. There's no way I can do 30 years, especially if you've never been locked up before. They tell you 30 years. It's like, oh, wow, 30 years? I can't do 30 years, so I'm going to go ahead and do 3 years even though I'm innocent. And that ain't even going to, like, the Khalif Brown, was that his name? Khalif Brown? I don't want to get the name right, but just like the story, the guy that they did that to him, he was from New York. I think he's from the Bronx, New York. They did the name. He was on Rikers Island for like 3 years for something he didn't do, fighting his case, and they kept coming to him with deals. Like, okay, you take this, you get out today. And he was like, no, I didn't do it. So why I'm going? And then he finally got out. But he had experienced so much on Rikers Island and everything he was going through, getting guards abusing him, other inmates attacking him. And he just got out. He was just mentally exhausted that he ended up killing himself. And that's a lot of people. That happens with a lot of people that are innocent and go through that. And then on the federal level, they might have something on you, but they would add other stuff. And it just in the court system, they have a thing in the federal system called ghost dope, which means they can arrest you, indict you for drugs that they never got off of you. They just say, we got word that you was moving this amount of drugs a month for 3 years, and so that's what we're charging you with. We don't have to have it. This is what somebody told us, and this is what we're going off of.
Wow. Wow.
And then they, yeah, it's called ghost dope. That's what it's called, ghost. You never see none of that. And then while you're sitting there, someone who's also facing federal time that wants to get some time back, they don't even have to know you. They can just hear you say something about your case. They go tell their lawyer, yeah, I want to cooperate on the guy that came in. He was telling another guy this is what he had. And so he's going to go tell the prosecutor over that guy's case. He said he was getting this and this and that. And then they're going to cut him a deal and go back to the guy and say, we're going to put some more ghost up on you because you was talking inside of this federal holdover saying that you was getting this amount of drugs for this long. So we're going to add that. And so now you got 30 years worth of drugs, a ghost dope on you, and you're going to lose. If you go to trial, you're going to lose. If you got a criminal history, they're going to say, well, you're going to take this 20 years, or we're going to 851 you because you got a criminal history, and it's going to give you life in a federal prison. And they don't have a dope or nothing.
We talked briefly about this the other day, Cardell. What is? I have a problem pronouncing the word prosecute. You said it the other day for me. Prosecutory misconduct.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's part of the prosecutorial misconduct. That's what they're gonna
do. Right.
And they know people. They normally put people on trial. The feds got it real bad. They normally allow people to go on trial against someone knowing that they don't even know the person or never been around a person or nothing. He was like, oh, yeah, I know him. Yeah, and back in, because especially on conspiracy cases, that's why a lot of the federal cases in drugs be conspiracy cases, because it's so easy to just say, if me and you, say us three that's on the phone, say it's somebody that one of you all talk to that I don't even know, but they say, yeah, she was talking to Cardell and she was getting it from Cardell, but they caught that person that I don't know that you know, that person that I don't even know would get on the stand and say, yeah, I got that from Cardell, and I ain't never seen him in my life, but he's part of the conspiracy.
Mm-mm.
Wow.
And the prosecutors know this. And they know this. I've seen a lot of people. It's sad and it's crazy. And so you left with an ultimatum. Is you're going to take this. The first thing you're going to feds is they're going to give you a lawyer. The first thing your lawyer is going to say is, do you want to cooperate? That's what they're going to ask you. That's the first question they're going to ask you. You want to cooperate? You know, yes or no? You know, so when you say no, now this, who can they build the case up against you to get you the time? If you're on a conspiracy, you got, like, I had 31 people got arrested with me. So once I said no, they say, well, you know, after these 30 other people, we're going to find 10 people that's going to say something about you to get you out. And then there's going to be other people that's going to come out of nowhere. And the prosecuting them know this, and they know this to be a lie, but I mean, it's total misconduct, but is you versus the United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
And so you wonder how, like, you know, how can you, you know, somebody want to get their time back, they're called in the prison system, what we call jump on your case. If somebody you don't even know want to give some time back, they'll jump on your case and make up a story and say, yeah, I was with such and such, and he went through Cardell. You know, he even got this from Cardell for me, and you don't even know this person, and it's a total lie, it's fabricated, but they want to get some time back, and they ain't got no problem cooperating, so they jump on your case.
You know, it's a shame. There's so much injustice in this country. I just can't believe
it's
it.
Terrible.
I can't believe that these things, and the recidivism rate in other countries are just so low, and they're doing so many things right. And this country being too gung-ho to even try to follow suit with them or try to learn more about them. And I know some politicians, some people did go over to, I believe it was Germany, also the Netherlands. And if people go on the Internet and they even type in, you know, Netherlands compared to the United States, I mean, they're going to find the differences. And this country, there's so much corruption and deception. And people are complaining all the time, especially those who have loved ones and friends inside. But I always tell these people, if you don't like what's going on, be a part of the resolution. Because if they do nothing, they're part of the problem. And all they need to do is go on the Internet and type in legislative members in whatever state they're in and start making calls to these people and saying they want to see some changes, prison reform or something. But there's
wow.
So many people that are liking postings and everything on Facebook. They'll click on like, but that's about it. There's so many families of loved ones incarcerated on Facebook talking about it, but yet doing nothing about it. They're part of the problem of their own loved ones if they don't participate in something to do something to make the changes. But this
right.
country, it has to change.
It's just like mandatory minimums. I mean, you have families against mandatory minimums over the last 5 to 10 years, they've been making a lot of noise, pushing forward the effort to get rid of the mandatory minimums in prison. But until they started pushing, the mandatory minimum was a lot. Until it was, I think it might have been, Brown versus the United States. But this allowed the judges to sentence people under mandatory minimums at their discretion. But prior to them, like, you might have people that got a first-time drug offense, and because the mandatory minimum says you were involved, your relevant conduct of this conspiracy was 100 kilos. Even though we didn't catch you with 100 kilos, just from what we hear, your relevant conduct was 100 kilos. So your sentencing guideline starts. Your sentencing guideline starts at 32. The federal has a sentencing guideline chart. On the left hand side is a column that goes up and down. It's what we call your number. What's your number? That's what we call your sentence number. It goes from 0 to like 42. Okay, so you got a column on the left hand side. Now at the top, there's a column at the top that goes from right to left, and it's criminal history. So this is how cold the federal system is. So when you catch an offense, your offense level, that's what it's called. The numbers on the left hand side going up and down is your offense level number. So like 100 kilos. So your offense level number 100 kilos is 32. So now going from right to left is going to be 5 columns at 32 that goes from right to left, and this is your criminal history points. Okay, so you can be a criminal history 0, criminal history 1, which is you never got into any criminal histories, and you got points, 0 to 3 points. That's criminal history number 1. Criminal history number 2 is 3 to 9 points. Then you got criminal history number 3 is 9 to 12. Then number 4 is 12 to 14. And number 5 is 14 on up points. So if you got a criminal history, like for every felony that you have, before the feds pick you up, any felonies you had before then is 3 points. And any misdemeanors is 1 point. So your offense level is 32. That goes up and down on the left. That's the offense that you caught with the federal. I got caught with, let's say, 100 kilos. You got offense level 32. A criminal history number 1 at 32, number 1 at 32 is like 210 months. And so if you got a bad criminal history and your criminal history is and your offense level is 32 on the federal guideline chart, and let's say your criminal history level is a 5, then you got 360 months to deceased. So not only does the federal not only are you getting sentenced for the crime that they got you on, you're getting sentenced for your criminal history as well.
Yeah.
So they double, yeah. So you're getting sentenced for your double history as well. So I'm looking at the federal guideline chart with a criminal history of 1. Let's say you've never been in trouble or not, but you get on a conspiracy and somebody says you're responsible for 100 kilos. So offense level would be 32. With no criminal history, you're going to have to do at least 121 months. Mandatory minimum, 121 months.
You know what? Watching that YouTube video on Norway yesterday, they were saying the maximum of any crime is 21 years or 25 years. I can't remember. It was under 25. And I'm saying that's what most, to my knowledge, that's what most countries do. They give a maximum. They don't take away all hope. They don't take away all hope and leave the incarcerated population with no men and women with no hope at all, other than to try to do away with their lives. I don't think any crime warrants that.
America's prison system and the way it was all designed was to take away hope. It was to take away hope and to build money. So when we trace back to the American prison system, let's just trace back to the 13th. Let's go to the 13th Amendment. This is very important for people to know. 13th Amendment says, you know, we're going to get rid of slavery unless duly convicted of a crime. So what that happens is, once Emancipation Proclamation happened and slavery was abolished, 13th Amendment abolished slavery. But what it did was allow, because unless duly convicted of a crime, they came up with what they call black codes or black laws, which allowed the slaves that were free, who, like, you was getting arrested for not having a place to live or just hanging out in the streets. So when you free the slaves, they had nowhere to go. They came up with laws that was going to allow to lock these slaves up. That was once slaves, now they're free. Now we came up with a law to lock them up. And so now we lock them up, and so what we do is convict leasing. Convict leasing is, now we're going to lease these ones that we locked up to farmers and stuff, and they're going to pay. They're going to get paid for their labor. And so that same mentality is in the prison today. It just carried on to prison. So now you got private prisons. You hear people talk about private prisons. So you got private prisons that are funded by, like, let's say IBM computers, or even Victoria's Secrets, where you got people. Idaho's a prime example. So Idaho, they do potatoes. So the Idaho Potato Company would get their labor from people in prison who would probably make in between 83 cents and $1.64 a day to go out in the field and plant and pull up potatoes and sack them and bag them and process them and everything else. Something that if the average person on the streets had that job, would probably make $15-$20 an hour doing this. So now we're looking at prison labor, and this is where the big businesses come in, because you have a lot of people that are invested in prison, whether they make, whether it's your state making license plate, or they making NVE in Missouri. We have NVE, and they make furniture for courtrooms, for county jails and judge chambers. They make the furniture, but they also make the license plates. So you're paying low labor. When I was in Missouri State Prison, I worked at the governor's mansion. And they paid, then this was a high paying job. They paid us $9 a day. But if someone on the streets had this job, they probably was making triple that an hour. And so that's where, when I say prisons is the big businesses come in, because this is where it comes in. And a lot of people in every prison, in almost every prison in the United States, has some kind of prison work program where you work in and you're making some, whereas computer chips for IBM. You're making these things and you're not getting paid nothing. Even with the pandemic, I guess people in prisons making masks. They might make 25 cents a day making masks, and they might make 100 masks that day. And people, and then the company is boxing them up and putting them on the market. And I was in the store the other day. A 50 box of masks costs you around $40. But the person who made the mask and put the mask together made 25 cents that day inside of a prison.
Wow.
And so that's how they make their money. Even now, like Missouri Department of MoDOT, Missouri Department of Transportation. Most states have a Department of Transportation. Then people that's on the sideline are out there cutting the grass on the highways, and them are prisoners.
Look at California. Remember the fire in California? They were using prisoners.
They prisoners to fight the fires.
If they're safe enough to let them out for things like that, pay them or release them because of good time or because of whatever, their community services. I'll tell you another thing. There's prisoners, actually, who would work for nothing in the prisons. They just want to have something to do. That 25 cents to them would be great, or 50 cents a day to them would be great, just to be able to have something to do. I know prisoners who have actually gotten jobs, and officials went over their head after a couple of weeks to have them fired. Just just to make problems for them. That's where you come in with the vengeance, the retaliation, or whatever. It's unbelievable. They don't pay them enough,
so
or they don't allow them to work at all.
And that's what they do. They take the hope off from you by sitting you for so much time. Like, the sentencing is outrageous. I was reading something the other day. They gave this one. He was a juvenile. He did an armed robbery. Nobody got killed. Nobody got murdered. But he was sentenced to 7 life sentences and plus 1,184 months.
That's a corrupt judge. That's a corrupt judge.
How did you get this much as a juvenile? You get this much sentence. I mean, one life sentence is enough. I mean, you know, but to say 7 life sentence plus 1,184 years.
It's like a first-time offender committing
numbers,
a first-time offender committing
now.
A first offense, getting a life in life without parole.
Right. But then that comes with in the federal system, that comes with the mandatory minimums, because the mandatory minimums was implemented in the Ronald Reagan, in part of what, you know, Reaganomics is what we call it. So when crack started hitting our communities, they came with mandatory minimums for that drug, which said if you get caught with crack, we're going to hit you hard. Mandatory minimum of let's say a mandatory minimum, it was 101 ratio, which means I can get caught with 100 ounces of regular cocaine if I was white, and I would get the less time or the same amount of time if you, being a black person, got caught with 1 ounce of crack. And so they introduced the mandatory minimums in over one night. It was 80-something mandatory minimums that was introduced to the federal system. And so now if you get caught with one of the mandatory minimums is what they have, a gun protecting dope charge in the federal system, which says if you get caught with guns and drugs, we're going to hit you with a gun, a charge with 924G or 924C. I can't remember. But it's saying that you got a gun and you drugs, you got a gun that's protecting the drugs. And that's a mandatory minimum of 5 years. You can't get nothing under it, but you can get something over it. Mandatory minimum. This is what it's a mandatory, this is what we have to give you.
Mandatory minimum is life or life without parole. That's the minimum. So what is the maximum? So they go with 3 and 4 life sentences for some. And I'm saying, you know, this is the mentality of a child. To be able to give somebody 3 consecutive life sentences or more, who lives to be over 80 or 90 years of age in this day and age, and yet they're getting 3 and 4 and 5? I mean, what kind of mentality is that for a judge to hand down something like that?
It's a game to them. It's a game to them. I mean, because and you can see the backlash. Because, you know, here over the last couple of years, people have been talking about we need to get rid of private prisons. So what happens is now they stop sending people to private prisons, and the private prisons turns around and sues the state that they're in because the state has made a promise. It's just like, what was the governor of John Kasich, governor of Ohio at one point in time. He used to work for the Lehman Brothers. The Lehman Brothers started the CCA, Correction Corporation of America. They usually house all the federal detainees before they get sentenced to go to federal prison. Federal holdover is what we call them. CCA, they're the number one correction corporation in America. So the Lehman Brothers, they started the Correction Corporation of America. John Kasich used to work for the Lehman Brothers. So when he went to Ohio, he sold the Ohio state prisons was getting in trouble. They needed funding. So what happened was, he sold, let's say, $200 million the prisons to the Lehman people. So they said, "Well, we'll contract you with these private prisons we'll buy them, but in the contract, you got to keep these prisons 90% full or 95% full. So once they started attacking the private prisons and started taking people out of these prisons, so now they weren't 95% full, the private prisons turned around and sued the states for breach of contract. Because in the contract, you're supposed to – it's all a game of business to them. So you breach a contract, so we're going to sue you because you're not – you're filling this up. So in order to not get sued, our job is to keep these prisons at 90%, the 95% capacity. However you got to do it, you got to do it.
They're trying to fill these prisons. So, like you say, it's about money. And you know what they say about money is the root of all evil.
Yeah. It's just like it's all corrupt. Just like it's about commercial transactions. Even with commercial banks and mortgages and investment banks and private prisons are all connected the same way. Because when you... commercial bank's job is to get people to get mortgages. Once they find people that get mortgages, they sell them mortgages. Say they have $1 billion worth of mortgages. They'll sell them $1 billion worth of mortgages to an investment bank for $250 million liquidity. And so now the investment banks have it, but the investment banks need security. So the security comes from private prisons. Well, how do private prisons do it? Well, we got 80% of our prisoners in these private prisons that's here for at least 10 years. So since we pay them $5 a day or $3 a day, what we make on the back end of what this really costs is the security, just in case these mortgages fail. Just in case these mortgages fail. See, it's a lot of things that run through prison that people just think that prison is about locking people up and then that's it. No, it's a lot of things behind prisons. From whether commercial bank and mortgages and investment banks, when people fail in their mortgages, what do you think is the security for the investment banks, private prisons?
Yeah.
A lot of your corporations have operations set in the private prisons to get their products made by prisoners who, if you're in prison and you don't have nobody sending you no money, making a dollar an hour is a blessing.
It is.
Because you might get $100 or $120, $150 a month from your job. And that's good money in prison, especially when you don't have nobody doing it. But the same job you're doing on the streets, someone is making $40,000, $50,000 a year. And you're making, at the most, $1,800 to $2,000 a year off this job. And that comes from the 13th Amendment. We abolishing slavery unless duly convicted of a crime. And I always tell people, it doesn't say duly convicted of a crime or in prison. So what would be the next step if they want to get nasty? So if you ever been convicted of a crime and you go to get a job and the job says, well, since you have been duly convicted of a crime, we don't have to pay you minimum wage. We can pay you this because the 13th Amendment says so.
It's crazy.
They just implement it in prison, but what happens if they start implementing it out of prison?
There's a lot of changes that need to be done. There really is. And, you know, I want to get back because we have about 15 minutes left. I want to get back to the work that you do, the organization you founded, because you're about to make some of those positive changes. And I want people to know more about your master, you know, the empowerment, your life, your work, everything about what you do. And also, please share with them a way to get in contact with you so that they can do some volunteer work or they can help in some way or another. So if you can talk more about that. And then towards the end, I'd like you to say a few things before we close too. But right now, Cardell, please talk more about what you do and what you want the audience to know.
Yeah, I want the audience to know with my felon reentry education program is broke down in different sessions. You have different sessions where it's broke down, but it's a mandatory. I'm pushing hard to get these felon reentry programs implemented inside of the prisons because, like I said, that's where it starts. So they can be prepared once they walk out of them gates, and then they still have us once they come out. With the felon reentry education, we focus on your social network. We focus on your preparation stage. We focus on your life skills. These are the things that we focus on. You know, we do inventory checks, as in while you're in prison, it's time to do an inventory check of where you're strong at and where you're weak at. Education. Are you strong on your education? You got GED. What about continuing education? What are you interested in? Do you want to start a business? Okay, do you have business education on how to do about it? So we focus on education. We focus on your housing. We focus on transportation. Do you have strong housing to go to? Do you have a functional house to go to? Because some people get out, and they even though they have a home plan, the household is dysfunctional, and that's not good for you. So that's what we focus on in the Federal Reentry Education Program. Do you want to get involved or you want to help out in any way with this program, you can go to our website, which is NorthOrg, NorthOrg.org. We also do other community events. We do Easter egg hunts. We do days in the park. We do life skills coach training. We have a chess class where we focus on strategy and teach the youth how to be able to think ahead, you know, and just critical thinking. So we do a lot of things. Also, with Visionary Hustle LLC, I do one-on-one coaching. It's called HAV coaching. HAV is an acronym of a book. I got a book called HAV, The Keys to Success, which HAV is an acronym for Hustle, Attitude, Vision, and Education. I always believe in order to be successful, for one, you got to have the right attitude and believe that you can be successful. Like I had to have the right attitude that I was greater than prison, that I can't come out and do something with myself. On top of that, you got to have a vision. You got to know where you're going. You got to have a destination. You got to know what you're seeing and what you want to be. Then you got to have education. You got to educate yourself on what it is that you're trying to do, what you want to do, because education is going to open up a lot of doors and it's going to navigate you through life. Then on top, once you got all that, you got to have a hustle. You got to get out there and put the work. So I came out with the keys, the keys to success. And you can go to my website, visionaryhustler.com. And if you want one-on-one coaching, I do free consultations. If you want to do that, just go to the website and schedule an appointment. Overall, I do the No New Numbers. That's my speaking to the youth. When COVID happened, it kind of slowed down. But I was going to the youth builds around the United States, youth build programs. If people don't know about youth build programs, they take people that have no GED, troubled teens that are 16 to 24 years old, and they give them the skill, help them get their GEDs. And, you know, so I go to the youth builds and I speak about no new numbers. No new numbers is real important because it's our future, and we're attacking the prison system by not allowing people to get in the prison system. That's the only one way you're going to defeat it, if you don't allow it. Teach them the necessities to not go to prison. Teach them how to beat the prison system. I always say you got to come up with a system to counteract the system. And that's what No New Numbers does, and that's what the Thunder Reentry Education does.
That is awesome. That is awesome. You know, I when I listen to you, I think of, and the situations were so different but yet similar, is Tukey Williams. You know, he was in prison on death row for a mistake. I won't even say it was a mistake. He was young and he started the Crips. But the man, being incarcerated all those years, he got so many awards. He got so many things for the productive things that he did while in prison. I mean, It was amazing, and everyone worldwide, there were so many people, worldwide advocates and others, that wanted to see this man freed because they felt that he could do more good on the outside with these young people than being on the inside sitting in death row. And unfortunately, that governor at the time, Arnold Schwarzenegger, he had him executed anyway. And even the people from his own country, Schwarzenegger's own country, a lot of them turned against him because they didn't think he did the right thing by having Tukey Williams killed. These are the type of situations that occur with people in prison. They can do so much better on the outside, especially when they've served a long time in prison, and they've seen and they've experienced the abuses, the deprivations, and all the things that go with it. The people that oversee the prisoners, they're human just like anybody else, and they also have criminal minds. And I just want the audience to know this, because some people think because someone wears a uniform, they can do no wrong. And sometimes it's those that are wearing the uniform that do so much damage. And unless it happens to you or to your loved one, you don't understand it. But that's why I say it's people in this country, if they really want to see positive change, then they need to start thinking, and they need to start listening, and they need to start acting. Because any day, it could be one of their own.
Yeah.
Any day.
And it's just bigger because people always say, well, they shouldn't deal with what they did to get in prison. It's bigger than that. It's so much
and they stereotype. That's it. They don't look. This Marianne Jacobs, who's going to be on the show next week, she said instead of looking at the individual that committed the crime, look at the cause behind it. Because so many people stereotype prisoners without even understanding or knowing what was going on at the time in their own mind, their own being. And sometimes it can be anything. It can be, like you said, you grew up in a drug-infested neighborhood. You know, you went through a lot growing up. And they don't look at what you went through. They look at the crime. But I always say, no child is born bad. You know, all children are born innocent. So somewhere along the line, between then and where they are today, something has had to happen. And we don't have role models out in the communities anymore. We have people that are judged without even knowing the person. We have people that have hatred for people they don't even know because of their pigmentation, you know, or their social status. And another thing is even the minorities themselves need to respect one another if they want the respect from the white man. Because we have so many people that came from prominent backgrounds who are of color. And they look down on their own because of drug-infested areas that their own came from, instead of trying to help them, which is what you're doing. And that's why I really admire what you're doing. And I hope and pray that you will get the right people to work with you in doing so.
Right. I really appreciate everybody's out there playing their part. Everybody has a part. So I just try to I just do my part. I do my part. I'm really passionate about it. I don't want to see young teenage. I don't want to see them getting numbers, getting caught up in the system. And I don't want to see those get out and go back. And so, like I say, success to me is not just walking down your probation, not just walking down your parole. It's never going back.
Exactly. Deborah, do you have any feedback or any words on that?
Well, I just say that, you know, I know as representing cases that we do need to do something in reference to the DA, the people that actually represent these cases, because once we all know how they operate with the cases, they already set, the DA already prepare and set what they want for these cases. And then they try to get you to take these pleas. And we really need our legislators put things in place that they're not the highest point for these for our cases, too, because I've seen a lot of corruptness in the DA. I sat there in court cases, and it was a problem because I knew the truth in a lot of things, but they try to hide things as things was discussed, and they're not fair, and they are not treating people equal. So we do need people, an advocate, and people that know how the system runs to definitely stand up for the people that's not a voice for themselves. I really feel that. That should definitely be in place for you know, the people, and also for that preventive services, too, that we do need to reach out to prevent a lot of these things from happening that could be prevented. Also, on behalf of the people in the community, we do need more advocate groups, too, in the prison and out the prisons to represent our people. That's one thing for sure. That's what, if any money in place for people to advocate and people on the outside or what have you to go inside to find out what's going on and what's really, because, and also that shock program, they need to do more about that shock program because there's a lot of stuff, abuse going on up there in Chattawa for that shock program and how these people trying to take these 6 months to get out. That's something that needs to be looked in a whole lot more, too. So there's a lot of things that our advocate and people that are standing up in and out that we really need to do, and our legislators need to be sticking behind us more. And especially we need to let them know before it becomes to that voting time, we need to reach out to the communities so they know that what's needed, and they need to be more aware of what is actually taking place and what our needs are in the system, in the prisons, and on our streets and our communities.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Well, if you and Deborah want to talk about this at another time, you know, you can. I can share your numbers, but right now we have about 4 minutes left, and what you both were talking about makes so much sense. And I hope and pray the audience in hearing this will be contacting you, because this is something, or even going to the Facebook pages and leaving a message, because even with everything going on in this world today, everything going on in this country, especially with the pandemic, what's happening right now is the prisoners are suffering enough. And now with this pandemic, they're confined to their cells 23 hours a day. They have no hope. A lot of them have no televisions. And again, people stereotype prisoners, but they have to look at the situations because each situation is different. And to have a life sentence based on a first mistake, or to have a life sentence and life sentences without parole for any individual, knowing that their background, and that's what we have to look at, is we have to look at the background, we have to look at the family composition, we have to look at the state of mind the person was in at the time, we have to look at the issues of drug, again, substances, we have to look at the issues of mental health, and Cardell, what you were saying about mental health as well. These are the issues that we need to focus on. And with what you're doing right now, I hope that there's going to be a lot of people that are going to be contacting you through your Facebook page or other so that they can start helping and working with you and possibly doing anything that they can to contact our state legislature, whichever state they are in, to ask them to start making some changes within the penal system, to ask them to start working with advocates and activists, and to do whatever they can to make this a better country. Because right now this country is being brought down. People are hating without causes, without even knowing another individual. The penal system is making all kinds of money off of these prisoners because no one is overseeing them. There has to be committees that can go into the prisons. And if they can't go into the prison, set up Skype meetings or Zoom meetings so that they can talk to prisoners themselves. The media needs to get more involved. The media needs to start going in instead of taking sides without even knowing the other side. And this is what we're listening to, one-sided stories, and where there's always two to three stories beyond that. I want to thank you, Cardell, and also Deborah. I want to thank you both for being on the show with us. I want the audience to know that this is how you start networking nationwide to make positive changes. And, Cardell, I'm hoping that we can have you back on in a week or two, so that you can talk more on what you're doing and to update us on any progress that's been made since this interview. And if you have
anytime,
any last words, please.
Yeah, anytime. I appreciate you having me on. Thanks a lot. And, I'll be available anytime. I'll come on anytime you need me. I'm always about it. Helping out, voicing my opinion on this particular situation that I know I'm very knowledgeable of and been in.
Okay, perhaps we can have you on in a couple of weeks, and I'll be talking with you before then anyway, so we can talk about the date and the time, or you can email me a date and a time, and I can set it up. for 2 weeks because I have a few people coming on next week. So the week after would be fine if you can send me some dates and times. And I thank you again for being on with us. It's been an honor having you on, and I really, really am inspired by what you're doing. And you're a perfect example of someone that came and transformed his life from felon to certified entrepreneur. So we thank you for being on with us.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you, Deborah, for being on as co-host today, Deborah Cecere. I really appreciate you being on. If you have any last-minute words, please do say it.
Just continue everything that we are doing, and we could do it when we all do it in numbers, and we do it together.
And I'll say amen to that. Thank you so much, both of you.
So indeed.
And we look forward to the next interview. Thank you so much. And we are now signing off.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right.